Hello, welcome to another episode of the Failery Podcast, where we rewind the tape of founders' journey and unlock critical takeaways that you can apply to your business. I am Brendan Hendoko, and on this episode, I'm very excited to be joined by Ryan Hickman, who is the founder at Epic AI, a company that helps startup founders across the spectrum with their multitude of AI-based tools, ranging from investor intelligence to decking. Before this, Ryan also ran another company with the same co-founder called Mevee, a mobile live streaming platform that dominated live video virality before Snap, Periscope, and at the time, the newly announced Facebook Live. Along with the incredible insights from that journey, in this episode, Ryan and I discuss the idea of first mover advantage and disadvantage, shiny object syndrome, and Ryan's experience with Waffles and Alicia Keys. Sit tight, get a notebook ready, and thank you for listening. This podcast wouldn't be possible without the help of our friends over at Referral Hero, the all-in-one platform to design and run flexible referral programs that grow your bottom line. If you're tired of wasting money on Facebook ads or writing tons of content that never rank on Google but already have loyal customers, you should definitely try a referral program. The Dollar Flight Club grew its business by 13%, and Holiday Pirates added 300,000 emails in less than a month after setting up their referral programs. The best thing about all of this is that you can get started in minutes with their no-code widgets, and if you sign up today, you can get 20% off with the code FAILERY20. Try it now for 14 days without any cost at referralhero.com. Once again, that's referralhero.com. Hello and welcome to another episode of the Failery Podcast, your one-stop shop for failed ventures and the founders behind them. I'm your host, Brendan Hendoko, and today I'm so excited to have Ryan Hickman on the show with us. Hello, Ryan. Thank you for being on the show.
How are you doing?
I'm doing well. How are you?
Fantastic.
Great. Ryan was previously the head of product at Thin Air. He was previously also the co-founder at Mevee, which was a mobile live streaming platform that I'd love to say was something that, you know, popped up before the huge giants that we know today at like TikTok, at Byte, etc. And currently Ryan is the founder at Epic AI. And Ryan has like a great history, but I'd love to just scale back. And, you know, I hope my summary did you justice, Ryan, but I'd love if you could just introduce yourself in any way possible you'd like to.
Absolutely. I am a very technology-centric frontiersman, if you will, focused on building technology that is oftentimes a few years ahead of its time. I'm currently a partner at Epic. Epic is a venture studio where we develop products around helping startups succeed across what we define as the founder's journey. So everything from the ideation of the business to the early validation of the business, funding, product development, all the way through to growth. We've created a myriad of different products that enable that. Over my career, I've created companies, some that have succeeded and have seen exits from, Adneedle, T-List, etc. I've also had companies that I've been behind that weren't so successful, such as Mevee, which is a lot of the reasons why we're here today.
Absolutely. Thank you so much. I feel like that one did much better than the one I tried to. But I'd love to just, you know, just jump into it. This is a great segue into my first question, but you talk about how, you know, you had companies that had like exits and then companies that didn't have exits. But I'd love to just, you know, get your, I guess, sentiment behind becoming a founder in the first place. Or like in 2009, actually, you started as the co-founder at Adneedle. I guess, what's your mantra behind that? Like, why did you go into startups first before working in industry?
So I actually was working at a bank at the time and seen opportunity. I guess I'm always looking for opportunities. I guess that any founder, anyone with that entrepreneurial spirit is always looking for new opportunities in everything that they do, whether they're ordering coffee at the Starbucks or they're, you know, experiencing something on an airplane. At the bank, there were these archaic processes in how they marketed to find new audiences. And, you know, as we start to see this transition, or I started to see this transition into digital media, I've seen that they just becoming more fragmented and had less idea of what was going on. They were spending more time trying to figure out how to prepare the marketing opposed to how to quantify it and really get that marketing out. And so it was in that moment where I spoke to the senior management and asked if they could be the first customer of this idea that I was working on. And they said, absolutely, anything to support. And before we knew it, we were 30K MRR on the second month of the business. And we built this platform that consolidated what today they call trade desks, but what consolidated the online advertising experience. So You log into one platform, you build your creative, your traffic, your creative from one platform, you pay for your insertions from one platform, you view your reporting from one platform. That amassed these incredible efficiencies to identify where there were problems in campaigns and where there's opportunities to scale. And I guess, you know, we continued to push that and we were fortunate enough to sell it to another company called Clickit. And it was the journey of trying to identify where the customers come from, how to keep those customers, how to innovate around those customers, where to focus your time. All of that magic, I think, became incredibly exciting and kind of encouraged me to go to the rodeo a second, third, fourth, fifth, sixth, seventh time. So yeah, after we sold Adneedle, I had a little surplus of cash. Adneedle was based out of upstate New York, outside of Albany. And what I started to do was to commute into New York City. And I met some gentlemen who were working on this NFC marketing platform. So this is before there's an Apple Pay. This is before there's a Google Wallet. And what we did was we took the bones of Adneedle, so this reporting mechanism, this ad trafficking mechanism, and connected it to the NFC technology at the time, which was incredibly magical. You take a phone, you touch something, you don't need to download an app, and whatever you touch calls a URL that makes magic happen on the phone. And from that relationship, we were able to build out Thin Air, and we built some incredible products for Google, Walgreens, Adidas, Samsung, Verizon. I mean, it was incredible. And leading into Mevy, when I left, I started an influencer platform because I just kind of been in this ad tech, you know, finding new ways to market online space in my head. And it successfully worked out for me. So I just kind of continued to nurture that. So we looked at this opportunity around celebrity influencers and we built this platform that allowed these influencers to pair with brands and deploy activations on Instagram and Facebook and Twitter, et cetera. We sold that. And on the back end of selling it, we were able to keep a technology license, which was one of the awesome things in that relationship. With that license, we crafted the foundation of Mevy. And it was, how could we take this model of influencer marketing and make it work for the hyper-local and the micro-influencers? Statistically, we've seen that the celebrity influencers were great. You know, an NBA player, Kim Kardashian, they post something and it definitely has a significant reach. But the metrics behind that reach and the way that impacted brand recall was significantly different than when you had 10 people that were part of a hyper-local or a micro community, and how much more influence was built into those experiences. And, you know, recognizing that there was this change in landscape into video and this push for video, we created Mevy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. That was a great, great summary. You know, you talk about Mevy with such this huge passion and, you know, you talk about how you're getting the influencers, how you're getting the micro influencers involved. And granted, I do like know the story, like I've read the story, but I'd love to know why you consider it a failure.
So from a learning point of view, it was wonderful. It's super cheap. Yeah. You know, I'm a programmer, right? So everything for me is math, right? So the math of Mevy is we spent a lot of time, spent a lot of capital to make it go, and we didn't achieve the ROI on the capital and the resources that we were looking for. So for that reason, I put it in the failure bucket.
Sure. And then you eventually shut down Mevy because you guys were competing in, you know, like against like Periscope, et cetera, et cetera. But yeah, absolutely. You know, I definitely agree with you on your sentiment of working on things that were like definitely before they're popular. You know, Mevy, we have Thin Air at NFC, doing like NFC. But yeah, you know, I'd love to take this chronologically and just go into Mevy. What would you describe Mevy did?
So Mevy was a live video streaming platform. So what today people refer to Periscope or IG Live is very much what Mevy was birthed around, with one primary driver being to mature to the partnered monetization model that YouTube has in its, but introduce that day one. So the Periscopes of the world, the Meerkats of the world are VC backed, they're focused on growth, and they weren't able to create those types of connections with the creators that was foundational to Mevy. So I'd say live video streaming platform is the best way to kind of put that in a box.
Uh-huh. Absolutely. And then your co-founder, Tamer, had connections that eventually negotiated y'all deals with, you know, NBA players like Ty Lawson and Trey Burke to become like influencers on your platform to, you know, share live video and make it very, very popular. I love, you know, just like to talk about the journey of that. Like, how did you, you know, decide on these players? How did you get these players?
So Tomer is incredibly connected to that world. One of his great friends is Billy Hunter, who ran the NBA Players Association. And, you know, the Players Associations is responsible for helping amass wealth and fight for opportunity for the entire NBA. So the access was unprecedented. And, you know, what we were able to do was rapidly produce a prototype and get it into the hands, in the prototype of the business, not just the technology, and get it into the hands of some very excited agents, because the agents expressed a problem often to him. It was, you know, I just signed an amazing contract and I recognize the importance of my brand because I can get hurt any day. And if I'm hurt, I lose access to this windfall of opportunity in life. And, you know, there's the one percenters like the LeBron James who are going to get these amazing Nike contracts. But right now I'm unknown, I'm unheard of. How could I show brands that I have influence? How could I show brands that I have impact? And then how could I monetize that along this journey? So for us, it was taking the ideology of the influencer platform that we had and the understandings around that data and surfacing the solution to this hurt that these players were expressing. We kind of architected the, call it prototype. I mean, it was pretty advanced prototype, but we architected the prototype around that solution. And they were excited. They were all in it. Everybody we showed it to, they said, this is the future. This is what we want to work on. This is what we want to do. Because, you know, these guys have 100,000 followers, 1 million followers, 3 million followers on these social platforms, and they can't get any brand deals because they don't have 100 million, 50 million followers. So it was extremely valued on their end where this potentially can go. So, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, I love that you talk about this being a very, very advanced product, as, you know, I don't think, or I'd love if you could touch on this, but this isn't your first rodeo in live video. You were previously, or I don't know if this was like prior to Adneedle Thin Air, but you worked on something called The Waffle Shop with CMU. You know, it was like a reality show where, you know, students ran the restaurant and the restaurant attendees were people on the reality show. I'd love if you could just, you know, just touch on that.
The Waffle Shop was incredible. John Rubin, who was a professor at CMU, reached out to me. And I don't even know how he got my contact. While originally I am from Pittsburgh, I didn't go to CMU. So the connection, I have no idea how it happened, but I got an email one day and said, I heard you can build anything. And I responded, absolutely. And we got on a Skype and he said, this is what I want to do. I want to open a waffle diner that only opens at 11 at night till 3 in the morning. And I only want to serve waffles and water, nothing else. No alcohol, no eggs, nothing, just waffles. And what I want to do is I want to put this in close proximity to the college bars that are nearby. And what I want to do is put a stage inside of the shop, well lit with cameras, and I want to stream live these chaotic instances in this very artistic way of people that are a little bit inebriated that come into this experience where there's only waffles, right? So everything about it is just weird. And they're live video streaming on a stage inside of this waffle shop, which is just weird. And we're going to put a host, David Letterman style, George Carson style, and we just want to capture these experiences. I said, I'm all in. And so we built this platform, and it, in his world, went extremely viral. And I thought it was incredible. And I got that experience, and that fueled this kind of expertise in being a live stream producer, if you will.
Sure.
And I was doing consultative work for Alicia Keys, helping her team with building their social media and their digital brand. And we worked on this really cool project called The Vault. And fast forward into The Vault, it was this in her physical studio. We went and she walked us downstairs and there's this giant safe and she opened it up and she's pulling out these photos with that are incredible. These collection of magazine covers, these songs that have never been heard of with the most amazing people in the world. And she says, what I want to do is I want to give this to my fans. I literally want to recreate this physical vault and put it on the internet so that my fans can experience this. And at the moment, I mentioned that, you know, I love everything about this, but the most magical part beyond the content, beyond this archive of amazingness, is you connecting to you. And I thought going live would be the best way. And I told her about her and Anne and the rest of the team. I told them about this waffle shop thing. And they said, wow, we want to do that, but like this, with this. And I said, great, let's do it. And we built the vault. And the vault was, you know, another case of being ahead of its time. It was a live streaming experience. You connected with your Facebook or your Twitter, or whatever, your email. And you were able to kind of chat in this commune way and engage Alicia in these live environments. People signed up to the vault, and whenever she went live, they received notifications. And a lot of that thinking was the foundation of what went into Meebee. Let's take the live streaming experiences that we have. Let's take the experiences from the influencer marketing and the advertising industry digitally. Let's take the network that we have from these athletes and extremely high net worth individuals. Let's even take the advertisers network of people that look to us to help them find opportunity to market online. And let's roll all of this up into an extremely intuitive, simple experience. Let's call it McCran. We only named it McCran because we had the domain already, and McCran meant projector in Hebrew. And Tomer, my partner, he's Israeli, he's Hebrew. And we thought that the connection between that worked really, really well. So we walked this McCran product into a many agents' office who represented players. We walked it into some brands who were excited about connecting with these NBA players in this very immersive way. And by the sixth, seventh day, we had a product. We had an advertiser. We had participation from some NBA players. We had a plan, and we were ready to take it and validate the product, validate the business model, and validate everything else in the spirit of Lean Startup.
Yeah, wow, absolutely. You know, I love that you touched on the topic of, like, you know, this was like your sixth, seventh day of building the, you know, Meevee or like McCran, or like you were wanting to validate the business model. Because from what I know, or like what I researched, this or Meevee or McCran was a experiment, or like it was something that you could do with live streaming. Yes, sir.
Absolutely. So we've seen all those different opportunities from our pasts and present, and we decided to pull them together to build out the experience of, can we build this idea? Can we prototype this idea? Can we get qualitative feedback around this idea? Can we actually onboard both sides of this constituency, of this marketplace? Can we get then the brand who would want to quantify or help monetize that side of the business? Then can we put this thing in the world in as short of a period as possible? And we very much did.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, it was great reading your story, but I'll link this, you know, in the description below. But, you know, y'all were just like an experiment that was, you know, testing out live streaming. And then, like, at one point you have like Ty Lawson, who was like an NBA player who was traded to the Kings. And he, you know, he looped here, like he recorded that on McCran. And then that went like extremely viral. It got over like a million loops within like the first couple hours. And then you guys were, you know, going toe-to-toe with these like eventually huge giants like Meerkat and Periscope. You know, they enter the market with different value props, and like Facebook ends up talking about like ending, or like they want to talk about going into, you know, live video. I guess
So Facebook, right? So we did the Ty Lawson thing. It was great. It went incredibly viral. We did not anticipate it to be so big. And that is when things got real. We changed the name from McCran to Meevee. We actually had a great friend who worked on the Android brand come in and help us with shifting it from McCran, which is actually really difficult to say, to Meevee, you know, Meevee, right? And, you know, he gave us the brand with the peace sign. And, you know, what sold it to us was, he said, listen, imagine that every time somebody goes live, they hold up the peace sign. Like, that's the best brand recognition ever. Then we learned a lot about the peace sign. In some countries, it's not great. Yeah, we learned that the hard way. nonetheless, we had this brand and we had another test that came down the funnel. You know, because people seen the success of Ty Lawson, they seen the use case of here's an influencer who is big, but not LeBron James, who went live, created, you know, low production cost content. And, you know, you don't need handlers, you don't need inline producers, you don't need lighting, you don't need all the stat, you don't need all of this. You just pull out our app, you hit record, you go live, you push that content to the internet, and you can monetize it with the brand. So a gentleman came to us and said, hey, the biggest show on VH1 is having their reunion special. And the main cast, one of the main cast members is having a party at their house. They've invited some of the other cast members to their house for this party, this watch party. I can have her go live on this platform with them kind of functioning as an echo chamber, supporting the brand, supporting the brand reach and affinity, and put this on your platform. I said, great, this sounds great. Little did we know it was going to go super viral. We thought, you know, maybe 3,000-4,000 people would be tuned into the stream at once. So we prepped the servers that way. And at the time, at that day, I had just built a house. I moved into the house. So we didn't have internet. We didn't have strong internet. So I was using the internet for my phone, which wasn't so great, just to check on everything to make sure everything was going to launch accordingly. The first commercial break, she went live for maybe 5 minutes. And there were like 60,000 people that hit the live stream all at once from her Twitter and Instagram channels. Crashed all the servers. I had to run and get to the nearest Starbucks, pull out all my machines, fire them up to the network, scale the infrastructure, and figure out how we were going to overcome that. It ended up being extremely successful because she went live during every commercial break. It ended up being an extremely successful experience. At that point, we raised some seed capital because we felt that, listen, you know, it's going to take a few more resources to take this thing to the next level. And we clearly have all signs of something that can be massive. We have market signals saying that, you know, live video is the future. We have our success cases showing we're able to realize that technology, our brand, these people that are users that are incredibly engaged. Everything was really highlighting the fact that we should go all in on this deal. So we did. We spent a few weeks and we developed a full version of Mevy with, you know, authentication and exploration views. And there were people graphs and profiles and all of the mechanics of a social network. We put Mevy into the market and it went live that January 3rd, I believe. That week, we found ourselves in the middle of CES and New York Times and Wall Street Journal. They're all writing. Listen, CES is about hardware. It's about electronics. All of a sudden, there's this showcase and highlight of app technology, and we were at the center of it. And now we're getting calls from people that are interested in investing. We're getting calls from people that are interested in doing partnerships. And this thing is it's starting to really take off. And there was an event. It was called the Periscope Summit. So news broke. Twitter had purchased Periscope. Meerkat's in the market, but it's dying. And really, the elephant in the room, the Goliath in the room, is Periscope. So they pulled together this event called the Periscope Summit. And we said, we got to crash this thing. We get to the Periscope Summit, and it's called the Periscope Summit. At the end of the first day, the name was changed to the Live Streaming Summit, which showed the impact. And to this day, it's still called the Live Streaming Summit. It showed the impact that we made in connecting to this community of creators, understanding their pain points and their desire to take on this as a career, be a content creator in this new dimension where it's not heavily produced like the YouTube stuff, and it's not soundtrack like, you know, the TikTok stuff today. And it worked. It was amazing. Many of the creators were able to be compensated for their brand activations on the platform. A lot of the creators went incredibly viral, but the cost of the servers to get it to the technology to work really well in Australia and Japan and Brazil, we had to set up additional infrastructure. Now we're spending $50,000 a month in servers and, you know, we need cash. So we said, let's raise some more capital. At the time, our offices were in Times Square and investors were excited to meet us. So they came to see us and, you know, they're walking through Times Square, and in the middle of Times Square, everywhere you look, there are Facebook Live ads. Not just one ad, but they bought the entire Times Square.
Oh gosh.
And the airports and everywhere.
Yeah.
This community of, you know, venture capitalists, everywhere that they're at, it says Facebook Live. And they would hear our pitch, they would love what we're doing, and end the meeting with, "But guys, there's no way you can compete with Facebook." And we couldn't raise the capital and had to dwindle the operation down. What is ironic is there was a deck that we created that we circulated to some folks that we wanted to have help in our partner programs, scale some of our influencers, scale some of the brand activations. Maybe 3 weeks or so after that deck began circulating, a Facebook deck with a lot of the similar ideology began circulating, and it hit our hands. And, you know, Facebook is just now realizing some of the things in both of the documents. But it's incredible to kind of see the influences. It's incredible to see kind of the impact that we were very much making. So, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, that was like incredible, incredible story, you know. And I love that you touched on, you know, this analogy or like this story that you guys circulated a deck and then, you know, Facebook came up with like almost the same stuff. I'd love to spin this into a question, you know, about first mover advantage. Because I'm also aware that you or Mevee rolled out, you know, banner and full screen ads in January of 2016. And then Snap did the same thing, June 2016. And then Periscope, March 17, Facebook Live, etc. You know, I'm just curious, I guess, working on something that I think you guys have documented as being, you know, first mover in like before pre-Meerkat, pre-Facebook Live, pre-TikTok, pre-everything. I'm curious what you think about your position, you know, like I think in the CES and like all the New York Times articles I've read, you guys were only talked about as like an upstart. You know, would you have released earlier? Would you have released later? I guess, did you like your position of being constantly compared to Facebook Live?
So to be part of the conversation was phenomenal. To make such a ripple that people that we didn't know that were in these incredibly authoritative positions compared us for us was incredibly validating. As far as first mover advantage, if you don't have the capital or the resources to grow, there can be big challenges there. I mean, it's a Lyft to Uber scenario, you know, it's a web crawler to Google scenario or Lycos to Google scenario. It gives the incumbents are always threatened by the capital and the innovation that the larger entities can build around what you're doing. And that's a hard place to be in. So I think if you have the opportunity for first move, it's important to brand around being that leader and make your brand about being that leader, because you've laid out the process. You've shown what works, what doesn't. So the learning curve is dramatically reduced. The bar is reduced for somebody to go in and just replicate the essentials of what you do and then put the magic that runs their operation on top of that and scale success a lot faster. I mean, you know, again, Facebook spent like $1.3 billion in advertising to become the de facto, the prominent, the leader. I mean, today it's IG Live and Facebook. I mean, the other technologies exist, but they're not prominent. You don't go on Periscope now and get 10,000 people to watch your live stream. That's not a reality anymore. It is a reality potentially on Instagram, IG Live, and that's very much because of the brand that they've created and the consolidation of audience that they created. So, you know, sometimes it hurts the heart to look back, but but to be honest, to know and have others have documented these timelines, like I didn't publish the Wall Street article, I didn't publish the New York Times article. Their timestamp, their, you know, that stuff is written in history for posterity. You can see that. And you know, it's validating it. You know, I know in my heart how it played out. And for that, I'm grateful. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, thank you for being, you know, so public, so open about it. But this segues into a great thing I'd like to ask you, you know, as someone who worked a little bit in live streaming, you know, at one point had Ty Lawson, at one point had, you know, so many, you had like a double-edged sword in the problem that like you had too many users that you had to scale your infrastructure up to accommodate for them. Or like the status quo today is like, you know, there's Facebook Gaming, Twitch, Mixer, you know, TikTok, but just like recently launched. It seems like everyone's trying to get into live streaming, or it seems like everyone's trying to, you know, be the de facto in live streaming. I'd love, you know, to get your thoughts today about it as like someone who is, you know, now a third party.
Interesting. So what television, what cable taught us is that people consume media in these time-shifted experiences. If you give them the opportunity to see something on demand or TiVo'd, if you will, they'll prefer that because they're people have busy lives. And even in MeVe, what we've seen was a trend of replays. More people would watch the replays. The replays had all the value. Live was a alignment of planets that you were had the right content, the right message. You were going live at the right moment when the right audience was on the app at the right time and committed with the right amount of time to appreciate your experience. That was hard to land every time. So the replays would reinforce those gaps. It would give those creators the metrics that they need to say, yeah, people still like me here. People still watch me here. It was able to give the creators that value in the sense that if I'm getting 10,000 views or 100,000 views, I know that I can still monetize that. So I'm committed to this platform because it's rewarding me traffic. So what Musical.ly showed us was that people are willing to consume content that is low production quality, short form, on demand. You know, TikTok acquires them, et cetera, et cetera. Or ByteDance acquires it, it rebrands it, TikTok, et cetera, et cetera. What TikTok is showing us is the identical thing, is that people are willing to consume these experiences. Now, there's a company called YouNow, and there are also a live video streaming experience, and they play with the digital currency and give you tokens that you can reward the creators. I bring them up to touch on a report that they worked on many moons ago that showed how much it costs to be a successful YouTube creator, and then how much does it cost to be a successful live media creator. And as you reduce the amount of production costs, you increase the margin. When the margin increases and the profitability increases, you're able to grow your audience size a lot faster. So I guess from the outside, I see two sides of the spectrum, one being extremely well-produced content in the arcs of, call it Netflix and Disney Plus, etc. Or I see the wave on the very short form, easily digestible format of content. The company that I'm most interested to kind of see their success rates is going to be Quibi, which is yeah, the medium between
the
two extremes. And I'm a really big believer in the messaging and story are bigger than the way it's produced. And again, TikTok quantifies that. And in many cases, the Netflixes of the world, the programming on the Netflixes of the world quantify that. So I'm kind of just on the sideline watching. There is a project that I have in my backlog that I want to work on. I'm waiting to see how Quibi comes together, because I think there's a perfect opportunity between what TikTok is on one end, what Quibi is short form on one end, what YouTube is in terms of monetization on one end, and then on the far, far end, what production level quality content Netflix looks like. So those are my two cents.
No, yeah, absolutely. You know, if anyone would be working on it, it'd be you, you know, post Waffle House, post MeVe, post, you know, The Vault with Alicia Keys. I have no doubt that, you know, you would at least make some ripples in the market. And I know you touched on a little bit on this, you know, in the eventual intersection between high quality and like easily on-demand content with Quibi. But I'd love to, you know, unlock any more thoughts you have about, you know, the future of live streaming. I think at least from a third person perspective, for me, who is like, granted, could be like uneducated because I haven't worked in, you know, live streaming, or like I only see it from like on my Twitter feed and like anything that I might research. But I think it seems like for me that there seems like not too much of a high barrier to entry. I think I compare it to food delivery in the sense that where a lot of food delivery is competing on, you know, price, because essentially they offer the same thing. I would say that live streaming, or like, you know, to the extent of like live gaming, et cetera, would compete around, you know, the repertoire of like who they have. So Mixer acquires, you know, the rights to Ninja, rights to Shroud, and then Facebook acquires the rights to Disguised Toast, who was like a popular Hearthstone streamer back in the day. and, you know, TikTok, you have whoever comes around on TikTok. Yeah, I'm just curious to know, you know, what your thoughts around this is, you know, like how would a player establish themselves as the de facto in, you know, live streaming in the future if it all seems to be, you know, competitive on one aspect that seems very, very, you know, random or like very arbitrary or like something that you have to funnel a lot of money into.
So it's all about content. It's no longer even about the platform and technology because of the barriers to entry. You know, now it's WebRTC and there's delivery mechanisms for it. I mean, somebody can build what Meevy was, what Periscope was, what Meerkat was in a day today. You know, even if they grew it from scratch and used, you know, an application like React Native or something similar, it would take them a day and or a few days, and they're live. That first week, they're live with an app. The thing that makes that homegrown app different from Periscope, different from Twitch, different from any of the other providers really has to deal with the content creators themselves. If you took Netflix and you took the originals off of Netflix, Netflix is no different than Epix. It's no different than Hulu. They're the same things, no different than even Amazon. But when you put that investment in and bear it, Netflix is a market, a data-driven company, right? So they're looking at data around consumption. They're looking at data around ROI and impact. They know if I put $1 billion investment into content exclusives and content production, that it will in fact improve subscriber rates, improve retention, improve CAGR. It will improve everything that makes a business successful, right? So if in fact they're a data-driven company and that data is signaling the value in producing original content, I would imagine that, you know, others are recognizing that, hence why Amazon Studios is investing in their own content, why Hulu is investing in its own content, and anybody who's in this, Disney, is investing in their own Disney, but they're investing in their own content to lure that audience, to create that differentiator. So anybody that's going to build in this space from a production or platform side, it's all about how you can have unique content that really excites the audience, that makes them willing to either add on your service or cut their other service to experience it on yours. And in no world is there a place where people only use one service. So, you know, people don't only want to watch one channel. You don't only watch USA. You watch USA and Fox and CBS and 30 other networks. You know, in this space, it's very much the same. I think that the more these platforms understand their communities and focus on that, what makes that community special, the more they'll succeed. So Twitch staying in their lane and in the gaming gamer archetype will allow them to succeed. The moment that you go to Twitch and you see cinematic horror films, there's going to be a disconnect, right? So
sure.
So, you know, I think it's about understanding that audience and creating original content experiences for them, and you'll differentiate. You know, YouTube is that exception, that anomalistic exception. I believe with YouTube, atrophy could definitely begin to kick in where there's this degrade in what the brand represents. So it's critical for them to get in front of that Gen Z edger audience. It's important for them to get in front of, you know, my kids. If my kids aren't saying YouTube, 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 then the size and brand impression and brand value and brand impact and market share we have mentally for YouTube will begin to deteriorate.
Yeah, absolutely. And I love to just, you know, take this chronologically. You know, you talk about maybe, you know, competing, like when you guys were taking like meetings for your investment rounds, and like people or folks would talk about you guys not being able to compete with, you know, Facebook, and you guys, I assume, like quietly shut it down. I guess I'm curious to know, you know, the transition between Meevy into your next company at Epic.
So when we were transitioning down on Meevy, we felt the fiduciary responsibility of somehow reconciling the investors that gave us the capital.
Right.
You know, these weren't professional investors who operate a VC fund who are expecting to take losses. These are angel investors. They are high net worth individuals, but they're not conditioned for loss in the same manner that a venture capitalist is. And so to reconcile them, we said, listen, everybody under the sun has called us and said, hey, can you make us a clone of your app? You know, we want to make a Meevy for churches or a Meevy for sports or, And we always turned it down and said, listen, we can launch a channel on Medium. And we looked at the margin and the cost and thought about how can we, you know, the first one came in, it was like, just change the logos. The second one said, you know, eliminate all this other stuff and just make it do this. The third one was like, you know, change the brand and make these changes. And the requirements list were very different per, but the foundation was the same. And we said, listen, how could we automate this so that we can make it as profitable as possible, get investors some capital back, and put this thing to bed through this extremely rigorous and immersive R&D process. We looked at how automation, and I try to loosely use the term artificial intelligence, but automation and artificial intelligence, how could we use these technologies to unlock a process that will help automate the requirements, production, the code, the design, the core design functions of getting these ideas from these potential customers who want to take Mevee and clone it. How can we do it using this manner and succeed? And that's when we created Crane. And Crane's really interesting. Crane uses computer vision. It uses knowledge graphs to kind of compute what you're going to do next in your software project. So the same type of recommendation experience that you get inside of your Gmail account when you begin typing a sentence and it shows your recommendation for the remaining part of the sentence is fundamentally what we do with Crane. You upload screens and we use computer vision, the same technology that self-driving cars uses to detect stop signs and pedestrians and buildings. We use to detect buttons and text and elements inside of a screen, and therefore we're able to then produce it to the same colors, to the same location in the screens, to the same functionality. We're even more so able to understand the context of that screen and build some of the, call it backend functionality around how that screen is going to connect to some server experience on it in the cloud. And as a result, we were able to build those apps. We delivered those apps. We sunsetted Mevee and began building out Crane. And part of what we found was that not only did people who were using us to build their software, not only did they did not understand how the software process and production worked, we recognized this gap between the needs of a estate company and then what they wanted to put into production or how they wanted to spend their resources to make it a version one that really felt most of the time like a version 10. So we began consulting these people to really refine their requirements so that they can use our development platform more efficiently. And that kind of transformed into this, well, wow, can you guys help me? Can you help me, you know, package this for raising capital, help me get a pitch deck, help me with my finances, help me with the financial models, help me with the company growth projections, help me identify how large the bottoms up, top down addressable market is. And we found ourselves kind of consulting and we said, well, wait a second. If we can automate the production of code, why can't we automate the production of building slide decks and building pitch decks and automate the process of reaching out to investors and building a network of investor relations? And could we then automate a process around growth and customer acquisition? And that's where Epic was born.
Yeah. Wow. I love to just, you know, like dive deep into this because you talk about how, you know, you felt the fiduciary responsibilities of, you know, returning money to the investors that participated in your seed round. And, you know, folks would reach out to you about, you know, cloning Mevee. And then, you know, you consulted for like decks. I'd love to just, you know, also just like think about how else you guys how are you sourcing the startups where, you know, Epic is like consulting for? Is it all through like inbound emails or?
So it's a myriad of techniques. I would say the strongest mechanism for us is ABM or account-based marketing, really understanding the traffic that we've been successful with that comes to our site. So if they're coming through search and, you know, we are able to detect, say, a data point like an email address because they sign up to get a guide, we can transform that email address into all of this data, this very rich data around the size of that organization, the role, that persona that came to the page, the market segment that they're in, this, the industry that they're in, and the trajectory of that industry, is it growing, is it shrinking? We take all of that data and we drop it into other tools, and those tools help us find similar audiences that we're able to market to via advertising online, via sites that they visit online that we push content to outbound emails that we're able to softly introduce ourselves through. And it's a strong marketing mix. What I find is when we rely on one channel by itself, what we'll tend to do is attribute all of the value to that one channel. When we add, you know, three channels, we'll look specifically to the last click model in that attribution chain, saying that, well, because they downloaded this guide and they came from the email that went out about the guide, it must have been the guide that is the reason that they become a customer. And what we've learned is the waiting on that distribution isn't as arbitrary as the last stage. The last stage is perhaps a deciding factor, but there are so many other touch points that make it go. So I guess what we've ultimately, with our DNA around how we find customers, is based on making sure we have a rich marketing mix in as many channels as we find effective. So, you know, again, press and blogging and retargeting advertising and PPC. I mean, a lot of people say, don't use paid marketing. If you're really small and you can afford to spend a small daily budget, spend a small daily budget so that you can at least appear in keywords where companies that are doing research around you can find you. So if I Google, you know, your startup, and you're not even on the first page, the buying consideration is going to drop. And then you're going to have false positives around the realities of what works and what doesn't. But I tend to be a big believer that make sure that you're mixing multiple channels together. Make sure that you're activating where people are going to look to whether or not to trust your brand or consider your brand or think that it's a scam. That's the nature of the internet. You send me an email or you tell me some cool value prop. I get to your site. Nothing about it is communicating the human side of the opportunity. There's no pictures of people. There's no phone numbers to contact or addresses that show the locality of the business. There's no chat. Or if there is a chat, nobody talks on the chat. All of these different nuances really make a difference in trust. And that trust is the driver of conversion. And a lot of early stage startups have the build it and they will come, you know, thought process. And we're strong believers that that's not, the distribution piece is so vital to product market fit. But
yeah, absolutely. And, you know, going from, you know, Epic's, I love to say Epic's wheelhouse of, you know, products, you have, you know, decking, investor intelligence, you know, software solutions, analytics, mentorship, et cetera, like everything under the sun. I'd love to just, you know, I guess, get your thoughts around what's your, you know, thought process around building a new, you know, solution? Like, how do you go about deciding whether or not building, you know, this product for mentorship is something that is needed? And yeah, like, I guess, how do you go about like using, you know, integrating, you know, quote unquote, artificial intelligence into building whatever product that you get, what is that you're building?
So I think the basis of it is about how quickly you can get feedback. Again, I'm a big believer that I'd rather drive 100 people to a phone call than to a self-service process, because I care less about if somebody can, for a first time, get to my user experience that nobody's ever used before and successfully use it. I don't have that expectation. Rather, I say, let me get on the phone with that person. Let me talk to them, or somebody from our team speak to them, understand that they understand our value, understand that they need that value and value it, and that they are being communicated to properly through our materials, that that's what the value of our platform is. And when we see that or don't, we know where to reinforce what we're doing. We know where to fortify what we're doing. And we tend to have way greater successes in our process. You know, when we start a new product, for us to get to 20K MRR within the first 3 months is a very, very achievable milestone, where I often see companies who create products that are, from a technical architecture,
they're great.
Like, they work well. There's few bugs. There's great, you know, documentation around pricing and how it works. They have videos. It looks amazing, but they can't get past $100 MRR.
Yeah.
And most of the time is because they don't touch their customer. Don't get on the phone. They don't talk. They don't really understand what the experience looks like to them. They only understand what the experience looks like to their internal team. So a lot of what Guy does is signaling. When we see people or hear people communicate to us that this is a problem, this is a hurt, and this is a value, if in fact we can connect the dots on that opportunity, we'll create the most minimal experience possible that gets the value prop across. I really believe if you're starting something out, put up a beautiful website. You can go to Avanto or any kind of platform, get a theme. You can grab, if you're a developer and you need to, you know, use a Jamstack, you can do all of that and download whatever pre-builds that you want. If you're anti-WordPress, I understand. WordPress is a it's a phenomenal tool though. So, but
sure.
Either case, fire up a site as quickly as possible. If it takes you a long time to fire up a website, it's going to take you even longer to get a customer. So put up that website and, you know, Calendly, HubSpot, there's so many solutions. Get that calendar invite widget on your site and start getting people to your site. If people are converting to get on the phone with you and talk to you, and you're learning this feedback and learning the value opportunities, you're going to get to a place where you can deliver the best product faster. And it's that value ecosystem that begins to compound. And $1 a month turns to $100 a month, turns to $1,000 a month. And that just keeps growing because you have that compound element in there because value is obvious. So if I was building anything, fire up that landing page.
No, absolutely. Yeah, that's great advice. And, you know, going from just like bridging the gap between, you know, Mevia and Epic, I know, you know, they're in different verticals where Mevia is working in, you know, live streaming, and then Epic is, you know, sort of like crafting, you know, this handicrafted experience for startups to like grow. I'd love to just, you know, get your thoughts around what are you bringing over? What are the lessons that you've gotten from Mevia that you're bringing over, you know, into Epic and like using as tangible insights?
One of the biggest things with Mevia was about lean startup methodology in its purest form. Again, I'm an engineer. The way I used to build product was open up my IDE, fire up my command line tools, start NPM installing a bunch of widgets and modules, and, you know, hit GitHub, look for some really cool frameworks and libraries to kind of accelerate and get caught off in the creative craft of code. And that's really fun. It's really, really fun. I really enjoy it. However, it is the kiss of death in the sense that you're putting this extra focus and pressure then on product. If you're a three-man team, then the conversations are, when you scrum and you get on the phone or you have your meetings, it's, how's the product coming along? We need to add this feature because that feature will conflict to this feature. Then you become a feature factory. Everything's about a product. And while there's a vision in mind, it becomes less and less achievable.
Yeah, shiny object syndrome, yeah.
Yes. the curious case of the shiny object syndrome. And what Mevia was about was, forget the code. Focus on all of the aspects that make the business go. Because an investor invests in a business. Customers subscribe and utilize a business. They don't utilize just the product. The product of Facebook isn't just you log in and your friends are there. You know, notifications and emails are crucial. And that's less of a code thing. It's more of a marketing thing. So it shows you that, you know, when you're building a business, marketing is inclusive, products inclusive, partners are inclusive, parts of the supply chain are inclusive, funding and capitalism and monetization and just operational resources are, you know, part of that foundation. So what the takeaway of Mevia is that you can build a very successful construct if you start by being as lean as possible and focus on building up each area of the business equally to produce value that is undeniably obvious and attractive. So
yeah, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. I hope this is like a well-worded question, but you know, with the rise of like consumer super apps in like Asia, I think also Connie Chan from A16Z talked about how in the future of, you know, consumer, everything will become a, you know, super app. And, you know, with you are like running a, something, you know, quote unquote, like a super startup or like helping like a venture studio that helps startups, you know, scale with like all of the products that you guys have. I guess I'm just curious to, you know, any thoughts or like any takes you might have here about, I guess, like, you know, one company doing everything or like everything becoming a super app in the future.
Capitalism makes it really tough. Competition, friendly yeah. Competition makes it really tough to believe that there's going to be a case of a super app in the Western side of the hemisphere.
Sure, sure.
You know, state ran, government ran, countries, I believe it's a lot more achievable because you don't have this disparate, disaligned interest. The interest is very hierarchically vertical. So in those countries like China, where you have WeChat, again, it's very viable. In this side of the world, I don't see it. I think people will get close, but I would imagine that legislation around monopolies are going to kick in. And I mean, the dialogues are happening now. Is Google a monopoly? I don't know. Is Apple, is Amazon a monopoly? I don't know. I think the super app of the future isn't going to be a quote app in the sense of
right,
a downloadable experience on your phone. I think the super app of the future on this side of the planet looks more like an Amazon, right? Really think about it, what Amazon is. I mean, their web cloud infrastructure is powering a large part of the internet. Their
e-commerce now, yeah,
is,
right.
You know, it's a federation of apps or experiences that can be coined as a super app. I think that's what it would look like on this side of the world. Not, I open up WeChat and everything's there.
Yeah, right. Wow. And I think, you know, Epic is on the forefront of doing that with, you know, Venture Studio or like doing things to help startup scale. But I'd love to, you know, this is a question, this is a tradition on the Failery podcast. But, you know, if Ryan, you know, circa today would have to talk to, you know, Ryan circa December of 2016, you know, post Mevy being sunset or like in the midst of Mevy being sunset, you know, thinking about like just transitioning or like just transitioning this into like a question about our listeners who are like founders, whether, you know, they are going through the trenches and it may be good and maybe like really, really terrible. I'd love to just like get your thoughts around what you would say to Ryan circa 2016.
Move your offices out of Times Square. I believe that we lost touch with the ideology of just ship it and focus on building the business more than the product. We got caught in the product cycle and started to innovate with technology. And that took away our focus from building the metrics that would have likely got us the additional funding that we needed before Facebook. So it became everybody's entering the space. So the investors say, well, how are you different? We should have continued to make how we're different the partnerships and the monetization. But because that's not tangible, we focused on then features, you know? So we were doing, you show up a peace sign, we use computer vision and we show little things happen in the background. And we were focused on things like that, using computer vision to detect when somebody puts explicit or inappropriate material on the platform, how we can automatically block the screen. Those things were really cool, but they weren't the true differentials. The true differentials are the business, not tech. I would say to my younger self, don't open VS Code. Do not do it. Go and shake more hands. Go and network more. Go and create more strategic partnerships because you can graph that. And that those numbers on that graph, on that chart that are going into that hockey stick formation or beginning to signal hockey stick formation is the exact reason that you'll get the capital that you need. The features that you're going to add are subjective. This investor says add you know, this feature, this investor says add that feature. Before you know it, after you've spoken to, you've courted 30 different investors, you have 30 different features, but there's no compound, no real compound interest between any 30 of those features for each of those 30 different archetypes of investors. So back to the drawing board, you don't have capital. If you want to raise that capital, build the business.
Yeah. Wow. Ryan, you know, thank you so much. You know, I bet that's like advice that would be, you know, applicable to my life, applicable to lots of the founders who are listening. But I'd love to just, you know, this is your moment here, you know, quick plug, Epic AI, but anywhere our, you know, listeners could find you, you know, on social media. What's your like, you know, preferred method of just getting in touch with or having folks get in touch with you?
I am old school. I don't do social media, but if you email me, I'm happy to respond. I'm ryan.hickman@epic.ai. And you can view all of our products at our website. And yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. If any of our listeners are willing to, you know, send Ryan snail mail or something, or like think about, you know, running their own reality show with like, you know, either like a Waffle House or like something else, X House, or, you know, looking for offices in Times Square, definitely reach out to Ryan. I'm sure he'd be happy to give you some consultation. But Ryan, thank you so much, you know, for making some time on the podcast. I've had a great, great pleasure. I hope you have had the same.
Awesome. Thank you so much for having me. This is amazing.
Absolutely. That was another episode of the Failure Podcast. Thank you for listening. We're doing a bunch of these in the future, so stick around. Thank you for tuning into this episode of the Failery Podcast. I've been Brandon Hendoko, and once more, I'd like to thank our friends over at Referral Hero for making this podcast episode possible. If you're looking to grow your business organically through word of mouth, make sure to check out their tool that'll allow you to create and grow a referral program within minutes. More than 7,000 companies are using it already, generating over 30 million leads, and now you can get it too for 20% off with the code FAILERY20. Try it now for 14 days without any cost at referralhero.com.